Davidson.
Morning.
All right, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratvold, Judge Cochran, and Judge Sleater, the Honorable Diane B. Bratvold presiding.
Good morning. Good morning to council. Good morning to my colleagues. This is the Minnesota Court of Appeals. As the marshal indicated, today's date is July 29th, 2020. We have three matters on our oral argument calendar. We are proceeding by WebEx oral argument pursuant to the current public health orders. And I just want to verify, I know that you've received, council have received instructions before coming online at this moment, but I want to make sure that both of you can hear me right now. Is that correct?
This is Doug Schmidt for the appellant, and I hear you loud and clear, Your Honor.
Excellent. And counsel for the respondent?
Your Honor.
All right. Very good. And then I know that both of you have instructions on what to do. If by some chance you have difficulty hearing or seeing, please alert us to that. And if by some odd chance you get completely disconnected, of course, I know you have procedures for doing that as well. So I'll make just a couple of initial remarks, but before I do that, I want to ask the marshal to call the first case on our calendar today. I think I already said we have three. Counsel for the first matter are here and present. So go right ahead, Marshal.
Now calling file number A20-0304, Philip Musselman et al. Versus Target Corporation et al.
All right, and I'm sure both of you are familiar with the procedures in our case. In our court, of course, ask any questions if you have them. The one thing I'll note is that in our transition to arguing via WebEx, we've noted that it's helpful if you mute your microphone while you are not speaking. Now, you don't have to do this all the time, but if you do it most of the time, it greatly improves the sound, our audio, as well as the recording, because we are recording these procedures. And you will see the judges do that. And then we will also take ourselves off mute when we have a question for you. So that's the first comment I want to make. Secondly, I'd like to remind you to both identify yourselves for the record, as well as the client that you represent before you start your remarks. Again, that's to keep our recording clear. And last but not least, I want to call your attention to what the marshal is doing right now. He's going to show you how the timekeeping device is going to work. So he's got a smartphone. He's going to keep it visible. If you have difficulty seeing the number that is currently there, don't hesitate during your remarks to just call that out and ask us how much time is remaining. But that's our timekeeping device. And of course, we'll make sure that you get the full amount of time. If there's any kind of a technical problem, or if you are having difficulty knowing how much time is remaining, we'll make sure that you get the correct amount. But in any event, I think with that, we're ready to proceed. So, counsel for appellant, we are ready to hear from you when you are ready. I think you are on mute. You listened to me too well.
Do you hear me now?
I can. Go right ahead.
May it please the court and counsel. Target's 10 deviations, each acknowledged by the trial court, by the district court, effectively overruled the doctor, Dr. Willis's medical plan and advice.
So, counsel, I'm going to stop you for just a moment. I bet you did this while you were on mute. If you would say one more time your name and that you represent Mr. Musselman, I'm sure you did it. We'll just
Do I get to start over again?
Yes, you get to start all over with a fresh 15 minutes.
My apologies. I didn't realize I should do that again.
No problem. My name is
Douglas Schmidt, and I represent Mr. and Mrs. Musselman, who are the plaintiffs in the district court and the appellants here before this honorable court. So, Your Honor, Target's 10 deviations from the standard of care and violation of the rules of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy overruled and contradicted the treatment plan that had been established by Dr. Mills, who recognized that the pharmacy, the drug that he was prescribing, had adverse effects, and as a precaution, set up a plan to start with a half dosage, a starter dosage, and then graduate to the full dosage. He sent two prescriptions over to Target. They were received. They were given prescription numbers. They were entered into Target's computer. There were two of them. And Counsel, somehow, by deviation from all the standards of care, only one of them was acknowledged and filled, and sadly, the wrong one. As a consequence.
Counsel, I have a question for you regarding something you just mentioned. Respondent argues that there's no evidence that Dr. Will's course of treatment, the sequence of the dosage, was conveyed to Target. Do you agree with that statement?
I agree that there's nothing in the record that would indicate that. But if you might, Your Honor, if Target had done their job, if they had followed the standard of care, if they'd followed the rules, they've got two competing and contradictory prescriptions in front of them, which is a huge, massive red flag. We've got two scripts here. What do we do? How do we fill out the label on each of those drugs as to the directions of use? It's a potential overdose problem of the highest degree. The whole
So, Counsel, I need to stop you for just a second. I mean, you're making a very passionate argument about the facts, and I understand why, in light of your view of what happened to Mr. Musselman. But I just want to pause for a second in terms of saying that these two prescriptions contradict each other. I mean, the doctor issued them. And if you know the treatment plan, they don't contradict each other at all, right?
If they're handled properly, I agree with that totally. But there are two of them coming in. And if they, with no instructions, no, they're totally at loss as to what to do with these two. It calls for a stop. The pinball machine goes tilt, and you say, what do we have here? How do we possibly fill out the label for usage? How do we tell, put on the label for the patient to take it? How do we properly fulfill our duty?
But we can just stop for a second. I want to make sure that we're looking at this case using the same lens that the district court judge used. And it seemed to me that in terms of understanding your theories for what duty was breached, the district court judge identified two of them. And one is that there was inadequate consultation by Target, that at a minimum, when they got these two prescriptions on the same day, even though they didn't know the treatment plan, Target didn't know the treatment plan, they should have consulted directly with the patient and said something like, do you know what you're supposed to do with these two prescriptions? Or perhaps even just telling Mr. Musselman, you know, we can fill one today, but we can't fill the other. Do you know what you're supposed to do? So that's one theory I saw in the district court's order. The second was similar. It's about, well, what should Target do? And that's what I think you're arguing now, to address a potentially duplicative prescription. Was there an error in the doctor's transmission because there are these two prescriptions that start on the same day? So did the district court judge have that part of your theory right? Is that your basic theory on what duties were breached?
I don't think that the district court understood the properly read the affidavit of our expert, Dr. Isis. And I missed the whole point. This district court judge acknowledged 10 deviations, and I'll submit to the court that those 10 deviations involve six places where there were safety checks required by the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, each of which would have caught this problem and resulted, presumably, in correction. And the consequence was that pharmacist Jones, when she or whoever it was that gave him the consultation, it's agreed that there was a consultation, and his testimony stands uncontradicted, that he was told, take the 300 millimeter at 9 o'clock in the morning. And that is a contradiction, overruling the doctor's plans. And that is not the proper subject of a pharmacist. And the pharmacist is basically the saying that their pill counters and bottle fillers is an insult to the Minnesota legislature, who declared pharmacists an important part of our healthcare providing provision system.
Mr. Schmidt, would you agree that there is no case law that identifies the specific standard of care in a malpractice involving pharmacists? And if that is true, what is the relevance directly of the professional guides and guidance that the association may have? And I assume that's the reference you're making to the 10 deviations.
Well, Your Honor, we have a plethora of case law that establishes medical malpractice, professional malpractice for lawyers, for nurses, for doctors. You're asking, do we have a specific case in our jurisprudence that applies it specifically to pharmacists? And I will answer that. I don't think there is one. And this court, the trial court, district court, and this court needs to look at the general rules that apply to medical malpractice cases. And
So counsel, I read the district court's opinion, the summary judgment decision, as well as the earlier order on dismissal, as saying that the board regulations, which we have a lot of evidence about those through Dr. Isett's affidavits, that those board regulations are evidence, if they're breached, are evidence of negligence. So, and you argue that in your brief on appeal. So I guess I'm trying to understand that it seems to me that the judge did make some preliminary legal determinations in your favor. Obviously, the judge granted summary judgment and found no duty, but the judge did make that ruling, right? And that is what you argue on appeal, that those regulations are evidence of negligence, correct?
Absolutely. You hit on an important point here, Your Honor. The trial court recognized specifically that violation of the rules of the Board of Pharmacy are evidence of negligence, just like violation of the traffic rules. I cite in my brief the building code. That's evidence of negligence. But then the trial court totally reversed its position, ignored that completely, reversed it 180 degrees, reversed its position, and ignored that evidence of negligence. When Target argues to you the board rules of the Board of Pharmacy are not evidence of negligence, and that Dr. Isett only relied on the rules, they're wrong. Dr. Isett said there is a deviation from the standard of care generally, and specifically with violation of the rules. To read the record as saying that he only relied on the rules and the rules don't count is wrong on two counts. The rules do count, and he didn't just rely on the rules.
So, counsel, can you give me a sense for what the evidence shows as to why Target did not fill both prescriptions on the same day? I saw different things in different parts of the record. It seemed that in the briefs on appeal, everyone alluded to some computer problems that Target had with installing a new system. But when I read Dr. Isett's affidavit, he referred to Target being out of stock of the 150 milligram tablets. So what was the evidence that the district court was given at summary judgment?
Well, the evidence at summary in the record was very clear that these two prescriptions were received electronically by Target and assigned prescription numbers in their system. They were logged in their system. And the first deviation was that the Target pharmacist violated the rule that you look at when you're filling any prescription, you look at in your computer and you look at the drug history of that patient. And it was there. When they filled the 300, the full dosage, three prescriptions before that in their system was the 150. and they didn't look, or if they did look, they ignored what they should have seen. If they
so, counsel, are you telling me that Target's testimony here is that they just didn't see the 150 milligram prescription, and that's why they didn't give it to him that day? I mean, that seems odd. I don't see that in the brief, so I'd be surprised if that's the evidence. So could you help me out there?
It is an absolute absence of any excuse, any justification offered by Target. They have admitted that it was there, and the prescription number was there, it was in their system, and they've offered no reason for not seeing it. But wait, carry on further. The rules of the Board of Pharmacy say that they're supposed to have a consultation with the patient and check it there. That's safety check. At the end of the shift, they're to do a quality control test. They should have caught it there. 3 days later, they offered no excuse whatsoever for why they filled the first one to be received, the 150 dosage, 3 days later. That's another violation, that they waited 3 days. They have an unexplained delay. Then 3 days later, when they fill the 150, which should have been given 3 days earlier, they don't pick up on that. They don't look. This is the fifth safety check that they ignore. They don't look and say, whoops, we're filling a 150 and we've just given him a 300 3 days ago. What's going on here? We got a duplication error that can lead to an overdose.
I would like to go back to your argument about the consultation rule. In your brief, you argue that if Target had followed the consultation rule, the consultation with the patient would have revealed that Musselman was receiving the incorrect dosage. What evidence in the record is there to support that argument, that the consultation would have revealed the incorrect dosage?
I think it's a matter of logic and common sense that if they see that there are two prescriptions, there's one for 150 and one for 300, wait a minute. The first thing they would have done is to ask Musselman, and he would have said, well, the doctor told me I was to take a half dosage for starters. Boom, there's the answer to it. Musselman's testimony.
So, counsel, I don't mean to jump in on Judge Cochran's question, but I have to say that leapt out at me, too, your answer. It sounds right based on the evidence. And what I struggle with is how is the pharmacist telling Mr. Musselman what he already knows? How is that causation a breach of the standard of care in this case? I'm just struggling with that. It seems like that at a minimum is a pretty significant argument for the defense on comparative fault, which of course goes to the jury. But I just struggle to see where the breach lies if all the pharmacist is doing in the consultation is getting Mr. Musselman to say what he already knows.
The point is that Musselman thought he was getting the starter dosage. He's not sophisticated. He doesn't know what those numbers mean. If you would have told him, if the pharmacist would have told him you're getting 150, we're getting 300, he would have got, okay, that must be the starter dosage. He didn't know that that was the full dosage. And that's the answer to that question, a proper consultation. There was a consultation, absolutely. And the consultation overruled the doctor's plan, advice, and instructions, and that's not the proper subject of a pharmacist.
So, counsel, we finished the first 15-minute segment of your argument. I think you know our rules and that you do have a 5-minute optional rebuttal if you choose. But at this point, I think we're ready to shift over and hear from counsel for the respondent. So thank you,
Your Honor.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is William Davidson. I represent the respondents, Target Corporation, and Paula Jones, the pharmacist involved here. Judge Frazier's grant of summary judgment should be affirmed. He issued a very detailed and well-reasoned opinion. He looked at this matter closely. As the court alluded to and is aware, Judge Frazier initially, about approximately a year earlier, issued a very thorough order granting partial Rule 12 motion to dismiss numerous claims. To be clear, those claims are not challenged on appeal. Appellants have not raised any issues regarding the various pharmaceutical rule breaches or the alleged breaches. As well, the negligence per se claim, which did survive the Rule 12 motion to dismiss, was dismissed on summary judgment, and appellants are not challenging the allegation that there was somehow a violation of Chapter 151, the statutes dealing with the regulation of pharmacies and pharmacists. So we're dealing strictly with the negligence or professional malpractice claim against Target and its pharmacist, Paula Jones, who for purposes of this argument, we assume and we agree was the pharmacist on duty the day of June 4th of 2014 when the initial dosage or the initial prescription was provided to Mr. Musselman. The facts may be disputed as to whether it was actually her, but for purposes of this appeal, we agree it was her. This is a summary judgment motion. This is not a Rule 12 motion appeal. This is not a, are there any facts possible type argument. The issue is for this court is, did Judge Frazier either abuse his discretion in rejecting the expert testimony that was proffered, or are there genuine issues of material fact, either as to the breach of the duty of the standard of care or causation? And we contend that Judge Frazier correctly applied the law, correctly applied Rule 56. There are potential de novo review issues for this court in terms of assessing whether or not there was a broader duty, whether the duty itself is as broad as appellants seem to be contending, that Ms. Jones or the pharmacist should have done more, should have questioned Dr. Will's apparent order of drugs being dispensed and his treatment plan. But we would contend that to the extent the court were to go into that realm, that that would be an issue implicating the learned intermediary doctrine and would not be a proper grant of or recognition of a duty.
So, counsel, I'd like to talk a bit about the foreign case law that you presented or your the defendants presented below to the district court and was discussed in the initial order dismissing, as you said, many of the plaintiff's claims. And then the district court definitely relied on it in the summary judgment motion as well, recognizing that Minnesota, as Judge Sleater said earlier, Minnesota doesn't appear to have any case law specifically characterizing the standard of care for a pharmacist. So looking at that foreign case law, you saw the reply argument of the appellant. They went into that case law and said, well, wait a second, you know, in filling a prescription accurately, a pharmacist still has a duty, and Judge Frazier recognized this too, has a duty to avoid active negligence and has a duty to correct patent errors, so errors on the face of the prescription. And I guess what I'm struggling with your position here today is that these are Target, apparently based on a standard favorable to the plaintiff here, reviewing the evidence favorable to them, Target received two prescriptions for the same person on the same to start on the same day in different doses, but the same drug.
Correct.
So isn't that at a minimum, in light of their expert testimony about what a pharmacist should do, isn't that a patent error, at least as a question of fact, whether there's a patent error there? So if you want to address that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure, Your Honor. And certainly the, well, let me first address your direct question. I do not believe it is a patent error. The two dosages, the 150 milligram and the 300 milligram, are both within the recommended acceptable dosage range for Wellbutrin, the brand name, or the bupropion, the generic name of this drug. In fact, the drug, according to the FDA and the evidence in the record, can be dispensed up to 450 milligrams. And so the notion that receiving on the same day two prescriptions, apparently three prescription numbers apart, at different dosage levels is somehow a patent error. We reject that, given that within the FDA dosage level itself, it's not improper. In fact, I believe plaintiffs or appellant's own experts recognize the different dosage of the Wellbutrin can be prescribed, and it would be proper, and that the potential adverse consequences, not to jump ahead to the causation argument.
Well, counsel, let's, again, viewing the evidence favorable to Mr. Musselman, so if it's not a patent error because it could have been the dose, isn't it at least a patent omission of instructions on how to take it? Because there were no instructions on this label or in the prescription that the pharmacist received, right?
That's my understanding, that the doctor did not provide specific instructions specifically as to take this one first, take this one second, which is our contention. And I believe appellants conceded that there's nothing in the record directing the pharmacist to provide that instruction.
And I realize you can make a very powerful defense argument based on that failure of the doctor to communicate the treatment plan. But it also seems to me to raise a pretty obvious argument for the plaintiffs in this case, that should have triggered the pharmacist's duty to consult with the patient and at a minimum say something along the lines of, you know, we got two prescriptions in for the same drug, different doses. Do you understand how you are supposed to take them?
And I certainly understand the argument the plaintiffs are making. I would contend, Your Honor, given the existing state of the law in Minnesota, that a pharmacist's duty is, in some respects, limited to accurately filling the prescriptions, which is what occurred here, and to not engage.
Counsel, when you say the existing state of the law in Minnesota, what are you referring to?
I'm referring to the general CIVJIG, and by analogy, looking at standard medical malpractice standards, what's the standard of care for a professional, in this case, a pharmacist. We do look at and we do rely upon the foreign jurisdictions that we cited below and that Judge Bradfold has referenced and all the parties have cited to, that the standard for pharmacists is to accurately fill prescriptions and to not engage in active negligence. And I would contend, Your Honor, and specifically Judge Bradfold, your question sounded to me as if the suggestion was that there was perhaps an omission by the pharmacist. They failed to do something that it would be nice had they done or caught, but I don't think that they're obligated to inquire to a degree, because to do so would interfere with the doctor's decision to.
So, counsel, what I struggle with your answer, and it's a perfectly good answer from your perspective and the view of the evidence, but we are required to view it favorably to the plaintiff today. And so they have presented quite a number of board regulations, and the district court judge recognized those, accepted them as giving evidence of negligence, which implies, you know, by saying evidence of negligence, the regulations themselves are then evidence of the standard of care. So, and those are Minnesota regulations. I mean, we aren't talking about foreign courts at all. So what do we do with that?
Two things I think you can do that with that, Your Honor. One, the references to the Board of Pharmacy violations, alleged violations, which we'll assume for purposes of today's argument, were established, that there's evidence that there were violations. We don't admit that, but we'll concede that. That goes to some of the earlier arguments that were dismissed, the counts that were dismissed. And I recognize that our brief, one of our headings, had a whether you call it a typo or a misnomer, when we contended violations of the rules are not evidence. They can be evidence, as Judge Frazier found. What they are not, however, is creating a duty. And that's the question of law for this court. Whether or not.
Well, let me correct you, because I think what the judge said, district court judge said, is true. They are not a standalone cause of action. That's different from saying creating a duty. Because if just hear me out. So if the regulations, just like the building code for contractors, if the regulations, breach of the regulations is evidence of negligence, then the regulations themselves are evidence of the standard of care. They aren't necessarily binding on the court or the jury, but they are evidence of what the standard of care should be. I mean, tell me why I'm wrong and give me some Minnesota case law that says that.
Sure. And Judge, maybe we're talking past each other or we're looking at the coin slightly differently. I do believe Judge Frazier, in his summary judgment order, concluded that the pharmacy rules and regs are not do not establish a duty. He earlier no doubt said that they do not create a standalone cause of action. That was his Rule 12 order, which he reiterated. But I think he said that they do not establish a duty. And that's really the arguably one of the $64,000 questions for this court. What is the duty? What is the standard of care? And we would contend respectfully that as an error-correcting court, it's not appropriate for this court to create a new duty on pharmacists that does not otherwise exist. To the extent the facts, the allegations and the facts of a supposed violation of the rules is evidence, it is evidence. I'll contend that the prepositional phrase of negligence subsumes a duty and assumes that a duty exists when it is evidence. Facts are facts. Whether they create a duty is a different issue, and we don't believe mm-hmm. that it does create a duty.
Mr. Davidson,
go ahead, Judge Sleeve.
I noticed that the judge used the phrase, it does not automatically create a duty, and maybe this gets to the, in part, semantics, but it does have a meaning to it. And my question is, he goes on to reference that it may be negligence, so separate from the private cause of action under those regulations. You made reference to the phrase active negligence as that phrase is used in these out-of-state cases. Are you arguing or you're claiming that even if we would apply that standard to a potential duty created by the regulations, that none of the regulations equal active negligence?
That is our contention, Your Honor, that what the pharmacist did here does not rise to the level of active negligence. And that taking that one step further, ultimately, getting back to one of Judge Bradfold's earlier questions, the contention that there was a failure to consult, and first, there was consultation both times, undisputed evidence as to that, but that the consultation was somehow deficient, we believe is an argument that fails because the supposed consultation that we're talking about is telling Mr. Musselman what he supposedly already knew. Now, one, it assumes that we knew that there was a particular order as to how this medication was supposed to be taken. And there's no
viewing the facts in the light most favorable to appellant, isn't there evidence that Mr. Musselman was told that the dosage that he was given was 150, not 300? And isn't that a negligent consultation?
The evidence in the light most favorable, yes, Mr. Musselman testified that the pharmacist said, oh, this is a new one for you. It's 150 milligrams, and I'm paraphrasing that. We do not believe that rises to the level of active negligence, even assuming those facts, when Mr. Musselman himself had been told there were going to be two prescriptions. And the pharmacist did not know what the order of prescriptions were. For all we knew, this was a situation where a higher dosage was supposed to be started, and then he was titrating down to a lower dosage.
So, counsel, I want to ask you the question I asked appellant's counsel, which is, what does the record show about why Target did not fill both prescriptions on the same day? I got confused the more I read the record. I read your briefs to say, generally refer to this computer error. Is that really the state of the record on why this happened? And you'll get more time to answer if you need it. So, go ahead.
Back then, I wrote down, we don't know why, and I think that's what the record shows. There's been argument from appellants that there was a computer malfunction. They alleged that in their complaint. For purposes of the record, there's no evidence of a computer malfunction. There was certainly no expert testimony as to how the computer erred or what the issues were.
There's no evidence, as Dr. Isitz indicates in his affidavit, there's no evidence that Target was just out of stock of the 150 milligrams?
I've not seen evidence of that one or the other, Your Honor. I think that's a possible explanation as to what happened, but we don't know. And when you have two competing possible explanations, one of which is not negligence, the failure to have it in stock, and if I may briefly, Your Honor, just conclude, those competing equally plausible conditions cannot be the basis for a negligence claim.
Thank you so much, counsel. I appreciate it. And I think as the marshal gets the clock set up, we'll be ready to go on to the reply or rebuttal argument. All right, and counsel for appellant, you've got 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Go right ahead.
Real quickly, to respond again, I think I, for fear of repeating myself, there is no excuse on Target's part for not looking at their system. It is uncontradicted that both prescriptions were logged into their system and given numbers. They were there. They didn't look. And the Board of Pharmacy requires them to look at the patient's history. The Board of Pharmacy requires them at the end of every shift to do a quality control and check. The Board of Pharmacy required that 3 days later when they're filling the what should have been the starter, they're supposed to check the history. Again, they would have seen that. And at the end, 3 days later when they fill it, the quality control check should have caught it again. There are six safety stops that were ignored.
So, counsel, I don't mean to stop you from presenting that argument, but I do, I'm mindful of our clock ticking down, and we have not heard from you on causation, and that was the second reason that the district court granted summary judgment. So I want to make sure that all the judges get a chance to ask any questions about causation. I have one, so I'll start us off. So I just want to make sure I understand your theory of damages, because of course that affects causation. And as I understand it, your theory of damages here is that, as of course that Mr. Musselman suffered greatly PTSD and in other ways as a result of this taking of the wrong dose for roughly 10, 15 days, something along those lines. But that's an aggravation, isn't it? Because everyone, the experts seem to acknowledge that this medication does have adverse side effects at any dose. Your experts present evidence saying it's worse at this quote unquote wrong dose that Mr. Musselman received. And so isn't it an aggravation or enhancement injury? That's certainly what the district court thought. So tell me if I'm wrong about that.
The district court completely misconstrued the exact language of Dr. Ice's affidavit and Dr. Lockman's affidavit. Both of them said that this is dose related. The more you take, the worse the result, just like drinking booze. The more you drink, the drunker you get. And they both said, we cannot say that there would be any adverse reaction at the 150 dose. The trial court twisted that around and said, well, a matter of fact, what they said was you'd have to speculate to say there was anything more than zero adverse effect. The trial court twisted that around, didn't give it the most favorable view, and said, oh, they're speculating as to whether there would have been any difference between the 150 and the 300. That's wrong. That is wrong, 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 not taking the affidavits in the light most favorable. Terrible.
So help me out, counsel, because it seems that if the district court did get this wrong, it starts with the first comment you made, which is that the adverse effects are dose related. So that there are going to be some adverse effects at any level with this medication. And the question is, how much worse are they for Mr. Musselman because he had, as you said, double the dose, okay? So getting back to my question, aren't you claiming an aggravation of injury based on the wrong dose, the double dose? Or do I have that wrong?
I can only answer that yes and no, Judge. Our experts say that there would be no adverse reaction at 150. And if that's true, then it's not an aggravation. If, on the other hand, it's construed the way a target wants to construe it, or that it's an increase, there would be some at 150, but it's an increase, then it is an aggravation. But the point, Your Honor, is that we're entitled to recover damages, whether it's an aggravation or a new injury. Makes no difference. Under Minnesota law, that's our entitlement.
Counsel, when you say it makes no difference whether that under Minnesota law you're entitled to recover even if it's an aggravation, what case law are you relying on?
Well, I've cited those in my brief, and I could pull that out, but it's well accepted.
But those relate to pre-existing conditions, correct? Can you cite any case similar to this that has a fact situation or scenario similar to this case?
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor. Could I make one point about the learned intermediary? Just one sentence.
I'm sorry, I'm muted. So, Counsel, I just want to point out, so your 5 minutes has elapsed. So at this point, I'd like you to sum up. And if you can do that and talk about learned intermediary, I'm happy to give you a minute to do that. But then we need to conclude the argument. Thank you.
Real quick, every single case of learned intermediary, and there are none in Minnesota, it is based on the failure to warn of adverse effects. And that is not even a part of our case. Every one of those learned intermediary cases are irrelevant to what we're dealing with here today. I want to sum up by saying this case really does have major statewide implications. This trial court said that pharmacists are bottle fillers and pill counters. That's an insult to the profession of pharmacy, and it's contrary to the statement by the Minnesota legislature that pharmacists are an important part of our healthcare delivery system. They're not just pill counters. You can't dismiss all the rules of the Board of Pharmacy by saying, they're just pill counters. And that's what this district court did, and I hope you don't do the same.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Counselor Appellant. Thank you, Counsel, for responding. We very much appreciate hearing from you today. Our conversations always help us as we go forward. So you both know, I think, that this is a matter now submitted to our court for its decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. So again, our thanks to both of you.